Once again, everyone, this is Henrik Palmgren, wherever you are. Around the world, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Follow us regularly on redicecreations.com for radio, news, TV programs, and much more. We have a bi-weekly newsletter, iPhone apps, RSS feeds, and many more ways. Our content can come directly to you. Please look at the website for much more. In 1967, Roger Patterson and Bob Gimley set out to film The Unknown, a creature of myth, legend, and folklore. On October 20th of that year, they captured the image of a terrifying man-beast, in which to this day still enthralls, enchants, and bewilders both scientists and laymen alike. The Patterson film is still by far the best all-around evidence of a Sasquatch creature to date. What if humanity has been living with another humanoid species alongside it for many hundreds of years, if not even longer, without the vast majority knowing about it? Well, today we are going to explore that question with Jeff Hilling, who is with us to talk about his book, The Great Bigfoot Film Mystery, What Really Happened on October 20th, 1967. Jeff Hilling is a Bigfoot historian and the creator of PattersonFilm.com, a website that takes a unique, neutral approach to dealing with the facts, legends, and rumors surrounding this most controversial film footage. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Jeff. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the program today. How are you?
I'm doing great, Henrik. Thanks for having me on your fine program.
Excellent. It's really nice. It's going to be interesting. We have the Bigfoot subject, the phenomena, almost we can call it, has come up with various guests now and then throughout, specifically with people like Lloyd Pye and so forth, when we were trying to figure out this mystery, of course. But what's interesting about your work is that you specifically have focused on probably one of the most exciting, one of the most biggest pieces of evidence for this. And this is, of course, pertaining to the Patterson film. And we're going to talk about this in some detail and about your book here today. But first of all, how long have you been interested in Bigfoot? When did this kind of kick off for you, Jeff?
I've been interested in Bigfoot most of my life, ever since I was small, seeing the Patterson film on various documentaries such as In Search Of, and Peter Graves did one called Mysterious Monsters that featured the Patterson films. And back in the 70s was the height of Patterson film mania and Bigfoot, in a sense, pop culture, at least here in North America. It really hit big once this film came out in 67. It really didn't hit till about mid-70s. So since then, I've had an interest in it. But it wasn't until about 6-7 years ago I really started deeply studying the mystery and all that surrounds the mystery of this film, and how amazed I was that over 40 years have transpired and we still haven't been able to either confirm or debunk what we see in this mysterious film that Roger Patterson shot back in 1967, and that it's actually kept people's interest. Both scientists and laymen alike have been studying this film for a very long time. And every decade, we've actually, technology has actually, I believe, helped the authenticity of this film, or at least helped the interest in this film along. Mm-hmm. Since digitization, stabilization, and things like that have come along, it didn't discredit the film. It actually made the film appear to be more credible, which I find fascinating, because usually when you find a counterfeit anything, you put it under a microscope, such as a dollar bill, a currency of any sort, and what happens is when you put it under a microscope, it tends to be revealed as a hoax rather quickly. And what has happened with the Patterson film is actually the opposite. We put this film under the microscope every single decade in different ways, different technologies. And it hasn't debunked the film. It's actually lent a lot more interest in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have there been other films that have been discredited along the way with the aid of new technology?
Well, the funny thing is most people aren't interested in a lot of the so-called Bigfoot footages out there other than the Patterson film, because The unique thing about this film, one of the unique things, is it the format it was filmed on. It was filmed on 16mm analog Kodachrome film, movie film. And that is a very, very high quality type of film compared to what people started using, in the 80s, videotape, and then now we've gone on to digital technology where everybody has a camera phone, a digital camera in their everything. Mm-hmm. And while that's more convenient, and people think we've come a long way, but at the same time, it's actually worse technology. What Roger Patterson was using was, it wasn't convenient. You had to get the stuff developed. It was expensive. You could only shoot it once. You couldn't tape over it. You had to get it developed in a lab. But we've been able to take a piece of this film with the Bigfoot creature in it and magnify it to the size of over 8 feet tall. I've seen blow-ups, pictures, just the creature itself, that are almost 8 feet tall. From a picture of a creature on a 16mm film that wasn't even a close-up. I mean, this thing was 100 yards away.
That's right.
So that says a lot about the format, the 16mm film that Roger Patterson was using back in 1967. That also is part of the reason why we don't see a lot of these other Bigfoot films analyzed, because you can't go any further, usually, with the format or the technology that they were filmed on. And usually people look at it once or twice. They try to magnify it a bit. They see it distorts rather rapidly, and it gets thrown into the ash heap of who knows, who cares.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just not that we're going to talk specifically about all of that today, but just going on YouTube, trying to find some of the related, obviously, other research that comes up in terms of the Patterson film and so forth. There's just so much out there. And there's so much junk out there too that you see right away. It's incredible, and that's why I think, as you say, that we end up in a safer zone the further back in history we go, and it's going to be proven to be more difficult to hoax it back then with the aid of the technology. But as you say, that the camera technology at that time though is exquisite. I mean, the analog beats the digital even today in many cases actually, and that's a really good point. Do you know where the original footage of this is today, Jeff?
Well, apparently, I think the very original footage got, from my research, got basically beat up. But Roger Patterson had several copies made of the very original film that he took out of that day. I think there was five copies made from the original, which are just about as good. And what happened in the late 60s, early 70s, he was roaming around basically the United States setting up shows with this film. He would set up movie theaters. He'd go into small movie theaters, high school auditoriums, gymnasiums, anywhere where he could set up chairs and charge $1.50 admission for people to see this film in his presentation. So I think the original got chewed up in the sprockets and whatnot. But a couple of the copies of it, which are very good copies of the original, still exist to this day. One of them is owned currently by his widow, Mrs. Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
And she, from what I hear, keeps it in a bank vault and doesn't let it out too much. She's let a few people look at it, and it's recently been digitized by a gentleman who's done some astonishing work on the digitization and stabilization. His name's Bill Munns, and he did a phenomenal job at digitizing this whole film frame by frame to get a really, really good copy for future generations, basically, because, the film will eventually degrade and dissolve and lose its resolution.
That's right. Some of the stabilization footage, I've seen some of that, too. That looks just phenomenal. That looks great. You can really, really see it in a detailed way. Why don't we talk a little bit about October 20th, 1967, then, and try to get into the details for those who don't know the story? I think almost everyone familiar, obviously, with the Bigfoot subject have seen this footage, or at least an image from it. But for those who don't know what happened, the background, maybe we can talk about that then, Jeff.
Yes, the background of the film. Basically, we see this. Everybody who's looked into Bigfoot has seen this film. You go on Google, you go on, you watch a documentary, and they're going to show this piece of filmage. It's from 1967. It's color film, and it's about a minute long. And basically, it took place by Roger Patterson. Well, first let me say he wrote a book in 1966, and that was called Do Abominable Snowmen of America Exist? And it was inspired by a lot of the, you know, abominable snowman sightings and things like that in the Himalayas and things like that. He was inspired by a lot of that work and started hearing about Bigfoot creatures in North America and looking into that, and because there's a rich folklore here of that. So he wrote this book in 1966, and then late 1967, October 20th, he and his cohort, Bob Gimlin, went to the northern woods of California, very heavily forested area. You have to get there either by horseback, usually, to get that deep into the woods where they were. They're about 30 miles into the forest. And they filmed this alleged man-beast creature that we see on film. They camped there a couple days, and they got up one morning, rode their horses around a creek bed, and claimed they got a Bigfoot on film. And what we see is what we get. We don't know if what they're saying is true at this point or whether it's a complete hoax, but that's what this mystery is all about, and that's what I look into in my book, The Great Bigfoot Film Mystery.
That's right. Do we know anything about how it unfolded or how it happened? Because as we know, it's fairly short, the amount of footage that they have of the creature basically walking away. It seems almost, when you look at the footage, like it's been, they just discovered it. You know, it's like, oh, there it is. I can't believe it. Let's take out the camera kind of thing. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it was the last minute on the reel of film. Those reels of film are usually about 5 minutes long. And they have been shooting just mundane footage all day, them hiking through the woods, you know, scenery, things like that. And the last minute of film actually runs out at the end is when they captured the Bigfoot creature. And at the beginning of the film, you notice it's very shaky, and that is because Roger Patterson was on the horseback at the time. They both had rifles, and the horse, as the story goes, is the testimonies I read in the magazine articles at the time, horse reared up when it saw the creature and threw Roger Patterson back. He grabbed his camera. He rolled off to the right in a tricky rodeo maneuver because he was a rodeo rider. And in one fell swoop, he ran to a log basically to stabilize himself to shoot the creature. So that's why at the beginning it's very hectic, very, very shaky, until it stabilizes a few seconds later.
That's right. And we have different versions of the, obviously, looking at the film, looking at the creature overall. One of the things that was has been a big interesting aspect of all this is that it's claimed that the creature is female as well. We can actually see breasts on the creature, which is a big kind of, if it's a hoax, why the heck would they do that? Tell us about that, Jeff.
Yeah, that's exactly a very good point. It's superfluous. It's not needed. You don't need to fake a Bigfoot film footage with breasts on a creature. In fact, if anything, you're risking a chance, if you're assuming this, you're doing this as a fake, you're risking a chance that what you're adding to the costume may reveal it to be a hoax because it wasn't done well enough. You know, how do you put breasts on a costume back in 1967 when you're not an established costume maker? Even the Hollywood level people at the time, I don't know that they could have done something like that well. I mean, I'm sure they could have, but you know, these things look real. We actually see in certain frames, if you blow it up, there's actually a movement to them, and a very quick movement, but they seem to be real. not like a, you know, you buy a gorilla suit and they got this plastic molded chest on there.
Right.
And then back then, I mean, what are you going to build onto a costume? What are you going to make this with? You know, it just seems like it's way too difficult that you would even want to attempt that if you didn't need to, especially.
Yeah.
It's one of the most fascinating parts about this. And I've said before, and I say this in my book, if this was a fake, if this were an illusion, this was the greatest illusion ever performed. This is greater than David Copperfield. This is something on the level of the paranormal. It's almost as if a man for a minute of time got into a monkey suit and then all of a sudden transformed into a real Bigfoot creature.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying that's what appears to have happened.
That's right.
I won't make that distinction. I'm not saying that's what really happened. That's what appears, what we see in this film. The thing looks real. We see muscle definition in this creature. We see muscle movements in this creature. And this was way before that kind of technology was going on in Hollywood. When we look at our best examples of what Hollywood movies had to offer back then, we look at Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. The beginning of it has these troglodyte ape-men creatures in there. That came out around that time. We also look at Planet of the Apes. These creatures are interesting, but they are not real. They don't look real. They don't display the types of characteristics that we see in the Patterson film creature. They really don't look anything alike, especially in the body part. Planet of the Apes, they focus more upon the masks, you know, and they did a pretty good job at the body wasn't going to fool anybody. You weren't seeing muscle definition in there.
No, I mean, exactly. They had, clothes on, costumes, basically just the hands and the head that they were working with in the Planet of the Apes. Now we're talking about a full body shot, you know, nude from that perspective, which complicates things radically, you know.
Exactly. And that is something that, could an average rodeo rider back in 1967 with very basic materials available? I mean, you got to realize we're in 1967. What kind of, let's say you want to build a Bigfoot costume, okay? What do you have to work with? Well, you got a gorilla suit. Maybe you could buy at a costume shop if you ordered it. The internet wasn't around. I mean, I think we got to get this internet mentality out of there. You couldn't just go to the internet and buy one online. There was maybe one or two companies that made them here in the United States, just cheap gorilla suits. And when I say cheap, I mean not anything that's going to fool anybody. It might be something you'd see in a B Hollywood movie, maybe a Three Stooges movie or a comedy like that, but nothing that would fool anything. So you had a couple different costume makers. You had a material out there that was primarily used by a lot of people in the fashion industry and the costume industry called Dianel. It's a fake fur. And pretty much everything in the 60s that was a furry, whether it was a costume or a fashion jacket or whatever, if it was fake fur, it was Dianel. Or you had the option of going to use a real animal hide. And the only one I could think of that possibly might work for that would be a bear.
To get the size of it, yeah?
The size and the hair type that we see in the Patterson film. But it doesn't look like bear fur. So basically, you only had a few options there. Either that or you went to a Hollywood-level person and you somehow talked them or put a whole lot of cash in front of them and they built you one. I don't know.
And then you say, oh, also, by the way, I need breasts on the thing. Can you do that?
Yeah. And by the way, throwing a pair of breasts, how much extra is that? You
right,
know,
right.
Exactly. I mean, they're going to think you're a fruitcake, but I don't know.
It's very interesting. And also then we have the aspect of how do you, you know, get into the suit. I mean, if we look at some of the musculature, some of the movements specifically of the thigh muscle, you would have to, and I heard this argued, I think it was by Lloyd Pye actually, he mentioned, it has to be glued onto the actual, you know, muscle underneath. But at the same time, there's a difficulty here because what's filmed here is is huge, and we'll talk about this because we know this because of the footprints that are left behind as well. So we know that it's big and it's heavy, which means that you would have to fill this out in some way. Meaning, do you pad it with something? And again, we're back to that idea. How do you glue? I mean, you must have glued it on there then or something. It's pretty much impossible. Your comments on that, Jeff?
Yeah, there's a lot of work involved with that. And that is something that's just not done just on the spur of the moment, the spur of the thought type of thing. You have to plan this stuff out very well. It's not just a matter of buying a gorilla suit and shoving pillows into it to fill it out.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes you look like a hockey goalie who's wearing too much equipment or something. You know, it doesn't give you a defined muscular look.
Mm.
It gives you a bulky look, or it'll be bulky in certain areas, loose in others. But that doesn't account for what we apparently see as muscle definition in there. It's very perplexing when you watch the film and you watch it closely and try to think, could this have been a costume? Or is this actually a real creature that we're witnessing?
Have you interviewed or maybe just talked with anyone who has been close to the film, the encounter? Obviously, we're just talking about Patterson and Gimlin here in this case, or anyone else that's been. We'll get into those who claim that this all was a hoax and who was behind it and so forth. But there's a number of those people as well. Have you been in contact with anyone of these and talked with them yourself?
Yeah, I've been in contact with some of them. Roger Patterson's dead, though. I mean, obviously, he's the man who filmed it. And by his testimonies, he left us a lot of testimony. He left us a lot of interviews, his book, things we can refer to in his own words that help deal with this mystery. Is it legit? But, yeah, then we get with testimonies as well. Bob Hieronymus. Bob Gimlin is the man who was with him. And he still shows up at Bigfoot conferences nowadays and gives his rendition of the story. And he hasn't really changed his story too much over the past few years. It's been fairly consistent. He says to this day that this was a legitimate creature. And if it wasn't, it was something done beyond his knowledge, which to me would be a very dangerous thing. If you're going to bring a guy out, a friend of yours, and you're going to have somebody dress up as Bigfoot, and your friend's got a rifle with you, you know, and he doesn't know that this is all a setup or a joke, you know, you could have deadly results with that. That's not a very good idea.
Yeah.
So I would think that that possibility probably wasn't an option. I don't think Roger Patterson would have done that, if nothing else, just for the safety of the guy in the suit.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Patterson, he died back in 72, and then... Bob Gimlin, though, he's still alive, right? He's around.
Yeah, I think he's about 80 years old. He's still showing up at these Bigfoot shows every now and again, once or twice a year. And they have a little event called the Yakima Roundup for him once a year where people, friends of his, get together and they talk about Bigfoot.
There you go. Do you know if he has been following the subject matter since? I mean, if it had an impact, I guess, on him, meaning that he wanted to try to figure out what or who it was or, you know, try to see more of them or something like that?
He's really hasn't done anything since then. For a long time, he was very quiet about the subject, and you can take that for whatever it's worth. But it wasn't until a few years ago that he really started getting invited to these things, these conferences, these Bigfoot roundups and whatnot, and he started showing up at them, making appearances and speeches at them. He doesn't do anything new with Bigfoot, as far as I know. Maybe he's done a little here and there, but he's not. I don't think he's out there searching like he did with Roger Patterson. I think he just primarily is there to show up and tell his story and, you know.
Yeah, and he's sticking to it. As you said, that's what's interesting about this. He hasn't changed his mind, obviously, and he's certain about what he saw. Maybe we also can talk a little bit about the the footprints left after this and what you have heard in regards to basically what happened after the movie, after the film runs out in the camera. Is the creature just walking away and they're trying to follow, or are they shocked, or are they just staying back? What do you know about that?
From the testimonies and everything I've done in my research, what I found out is, according to their own story, and this is all we have because the film ran out, but according to Roger and Bob's story, after the film ran out, the creature headed towards the heavily forested area and up a hill. And they followed after it, but lost it. In other words, it disappeared into the woods. And they didn't pursue it very far. Now, several days later, a man by the name of Bob Titmus came onto the scene to observe what had transpired there. And he found and saw the prints that Roger Patterson had reported. And Bob Titmus was actually a Bigfoot researcher of his own back in the 60s and 50s. He showed up there and took measurements of the cast, took some plaster casts for himself of the Bigfoot tracks, and he, according to his testimony, followed the trail up into the woods. So he had found the trail that was in the sandbar. This was a very sandy area, okay? This was a heavily logged area at the time, and it was mainly a very sandy surface there. And he followed, actually, the tracks further than what Roger and Bob said that they saw, according to his testimony, but lost it eventually in the forest. You know, the pine straw in the forest gets pretty thick at some point, and then you can't follow the tracks anymore.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
According to his testimony, there were some tracks going up into the woods, and he followed them until they couldn't be seen anymore.
Very interesting. On your page on PattersonFilm.com, your website, on the Who's Who page, we can see Roger Patterson standing there with two casts, I think, of footprints. Do you know if these are the ones from the actual the site there that were taken?
Yes, they were. Those were he took several casts, and those were two of the better ones that he got and was holding them up in that photo.
They're pretty big, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, those are big footprints, and you got to ask yourself this, too. This is part of the mystery a lot of people don't really think about, which I find very intriguing. You have a third-party witness analyzing basically a tale of the sand. You have a trail of footprints going through the sand. Bob Titmus comes by a few days later and checks out the scene. Now, if this were a fake, I would think that you would have – it would be obvious with the testimony in the sand prints that something probably wasn't going on that was legit. In other words, you see too many footprints there. You see maybe a couple takes, practice runs, maybe a spot where the actor took the suit off. Or, you know, it's very interesting to think that this guy came by a few days later and saw these prints and wasn't saying to himself, this is a bunch of baloney.
Mm.
I would think if you were faking something, there would be evidence left in the tracks that wouldn't add up. And then you got to say to yourself, too, if this was a suit, were the tracks left by the suit as well? Or did they have to completely manufacture these tracks afterwards?
Right, some kind of right. Because, sorry to interrupt, but otherwise that would mean you would have to create some kind of shoe. Right, that would actually leave the impressions of the foot and the cast, basically, that it left after itself.
Exactly my point. So you're looking at not just a costume, because we can actually see the feet on film. So this would be a costume not just for aesthetics, not just for a visual gaffe, if you will, but it would also have to be a functional foot as well. To actually leave believable footprints. And these feet are huge, so basically it would be like walking in oversized clown shoes, or maybe equated to, if you've ever been scuba diving, you know, you put those flippers on. I mean, how easy is it to walk in something like that? This was done in a very fluid way when you watch the film. In other words, if this was a guy in a suit, He was walking as if he was very comfortable and had no problems walking through the sand, rocks. There's trees all around, limbs. And he was walking flawlessly in oversized shoes, not stumbling, looking natural. And you had to keep this up for a minute of time. You know, this is something that if I think you were an actor doing this, you would at some point fall out of character in a sense. You'd stumble a little bit, trip. You'd look unnatural for a couple of seconds till you got your momentum again. These are things that I don't think people really think about when it comes to how this could have been performed if it were a fake.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And was there any other indication that you've heard in terms of, I don't know, sounds, even smells, or anything else that would indicate that it's the real deal, so to speak?
Well, the camera didn't have any sound on it, unfortunately.
That's right.
So
yeah.
We don't have any audio from it. I wish we did. That would be an amazing element to the entire thing. I think they reported some kind of smell in the area, which, you know, you hear a lot about Bigfoot nowadays, and they always attribute a really foul odor
right
in the area.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I believe in a testimony or two, they did mention the smell.
That's right. So it's things that are adding to that story all the time. I want to talk a little bit about, obviously, some of the attempts to recreate this scenario, who has been involved in that. And basically, I guess, actually, if we could just run through some of the people on your Who's Who page, I think that would be pretty good. Obviously, we want to get to Bob Hieronymus primarily, but tell us about some of the major players in all of this, Jeff.
Sure. Well, other than Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, we have a man by the name of John Chambers at one point was accused of being the man who made the suit for the Patterson film. Now, who was John Chambers? He was the responsible for the costumery among Planet of the Apes, among other things. He's done a lot of work in Hollywood. That's one of his most notable ones. But he's done a lot of major work in Hollywood, especially during that era. And he actually had created a Bigfoot-like creature before. And I think this was part of the reason why that he got attributed the work of the Patterson film. In other words, and it was done by a guy, John Landis, who did the Animal House movie. He's the one who started saying, well, it was John Chambers. Everybody knows in Hollywood that he made that suit. Well, John Chambers never said that himself, for one. And for two, in an interview that was done shortly before his death, he flat out said, I never made that suit. So, I mean, that kind of puts that theory to rest, I think. I mean, if he never said it in the first place and then somebody flat out asked him in an interview for the record, you know, I don't have any reason to believe that he would have made that suit. And I have no reason to believe either that Roger Patterson had any connections to him.
It's interesting, exactly, because if we try to figure out the reasoning here, and still try to stick with our, you know, this in mind that it's a hoax in one sense. And let's say then we have somebody responsible for making this costume, but then at the same time then denying it outwardly, saying, no, this is not what I did or whatever. What would be the purpose of that? Again, you would have to draw in people who are very, very skilled costume makers, potentially even Hollywood people. You would have to have some kind of contact, obviously, at some point between Patterson and these people, but as far as you know, then you haven't found anything like this. And again, what would be the incentive if you couldn't take credit for it afterwards to help sell your, you know, costume producing skills or whatever? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure John Chambers had a lot better things to do. If some rodeo rider from 1967 came up to him and said he wanted him to make a Bigfoot costume, he probably would have told him to take a hike. He's too busy doing movies and whatever else, you know. I mean, I don't think I could go up to a Hollywood guy unless I had a whole lot of money and have any interest in them making something of that nature. Like I said, that's one of those stories that I believe was like a it was almost like a, I said in my book, it's like a Hollywood homage to a great special effects artist. You know, I think people started that rumor almost to just as a tribute to him, to say, you know, hey, if anybody could have done it, it would have been John Chambers, because he's such a great costume maker. And I think it got blown out of proportion in the rumor mills. So I think that one is pretty much put to rest. I don't think anybody really stands by that claim too much anymore. But then what we had in a, you know, mid-2000s, we had a book come out by Greg Long claiming that a man by the name of Mr. Bob Hieronymus was the man in the suit, and that the costume itself was made by a man by the name of Philip Morris. And that's not to be confused with the tobacco company, Philip Morris.
Yeah.
He's the costume maker. And then Philip Morris has a background of being like a P.T. Barnum type character. He's kind of a showman, magician, worked in carnivals, things like that, stage productions. And he had a TV show, Dr. Evil's Saturday morning movie host, where he'd show bad movies and come out in his little shtick. And he was a costume maker, and he still makes costumes this day. He's still alive. And he makes good costumes, but they're usually not on the level of the costumes you buy from him. They're not on the level of something you would see in a major Hollywood production. You know, these are something you'd buy for a costume party. You can go to his website, check that out for yourself. And he claims he sold a gorilla suit to Roger Patterson back in late 60s, and Roger Patterson talked to him, asked him about altering the suit, and he said he gave him a few tips of advice, and then he saw the film later, not too long ago, after he talked to him, on television when the Patterson film started airing on TV. And this is a very strange story. How anybody can remember, for one, a business transaction they did about 40 years ago is beyond me. That's one thing that I found really strange, because he's telling this, you know, 35, almost 40 years later, he's making this claim. That doesn't seem to hold water with me. I don't know. And he also claimed that Roger Patterson made alterations to his suit, therefore making it into the suit we see in the Patterson film. Which to me, if you think about it this way, he's the master costume maker, Philip Morris. He sells a costume to a guy who has no working knowledge of costumery in any way, shape, or form that I could ever find, anybody would ever attest to. And this guy takes the guy's suit, who's a master costume maker, and he somehow makes it even better. He improves upon it. He makes it more realistic than the costume maker.
That is not an encouraging, self-promotion thing for your business.
What does that say about your costume?
Right.
Well, to me, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, take anything, for instance, that you buy at the store, whether it's a television, a car, it's a new sports coat. Take something that you have no working knowledge in, okay? Try to improve upon it. Try to alter it and try to make it look better somehow. And see how, and let me know how you do with that. You know, try taking apart your computer. Try to make it look like something completely different. You know, there's no way to do it unless you're some sort of have very skilled knowledge in something like that. When you start altering things from the factory, from the people who make it professionally, it tends to not look as good as it originally did if you don't know what you're really, really doing. You have to be an expert yourself. And this part of the story, just it seems very odd to me that you could take a cheap gorilla suit that's not going to fool anybody, maybe a four-year-old at a birthday party, and then alter it into a way that it fools everybody, including scientists and people who've analyzed this film for over 40 years. I'm not saying it can't be done, but it doesn't seem likely.
Well, exactly. Then we're back to that idea again, that if that is the case, then it's someone who really wants us to sit here and debate about the issue right now. It's a well-thought-out scheme, if I put it that way. Someone has really put a lot of thought and effort into this, and at the same time, unwilling to take the credit for it, but really want to see this whole, I don't know, elaborate hoax being played out through you know, many years now, basically.
Yeah, and that whole concept seems unlikely as well. For one, you don't know how it's going to look. You could have the best suit in the world, for one. Here's another thing about this film. It's not just about the suit. And it's not just about the actor playing the part in the suit. And it's not just about the filming. There's a certain synchronicity to all these things that are happening. You'd have to have happening and hitting on all cylinders all at once. In other words, you'd have to have a flawless motion, a perfect actor, the perfect suit, the perfect filming, the perfect distance, the perfect lighting. All these things would have to culminate together into this working in unison synchronicity for 1 minute on this film to make this thing believable. Because you could have a great suit, and then the actor flubs it up, or his motion gives it away, his gait gives it away, or a number of things could easily go wrong. And like I said, he was using 16mm film, and this is very important. When you understand that 16mm film cannot be duplicated, you can't tape over it over and over again like most of your younger people listening. You know, everything we've been able to record for many, many years now, we've been able to just tape right over it, whether it's videotape or digital camcorders. You can do endless takes. You can do 1,000 takes of if you're going to film a Bigfoot sequence nowadays. He had one chance, and the film ran out. There was no redoing this take over and over again. Plus, when you filmed that film back in 1967, you don't know whether or not what it looked like on the film. You don't have the capabilities of replaying what just happened. And all these factors together.
Do you know if even those cameras back then had a viewfinder for your eye that you could look into, or how did it look?
That particular camera that he used had through the lens viewing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was one thing that he did have going for him. But some of the cameras didn't back then. You had to look through a piece of plastic that gave you just a general idea of where it was going to be when you were looking. It wasn't even looking through the lens, but that one did have through the lens viewing. But needless to say, even though you're looking through the lens, you still can't replay what you just saw. You don't know how it actually came out on the film, if it was a little out of focus, if it was, you know, you got one shot at this thing. And what we see on the film was the result of a one-shot take, which is very difficult to get all these things working in unison, in synchronicity, for just one shot.
Mm. Wow, yeah, it's an incredible story, and nonetheless, then it's a great synchronicity to get it as well, if it is the real thing, because that means all the components of making this happen must be there and in place. First and foremost, obviously, the creature itself, because it's not too common that we get this kind of even reports or sightings. Obviously, they've been around, but to film it like this, that's an incredible event in that sense. Do you think that this is a one-off? How common is this? If we talk about how, you know, many creatures there might be out there, Bigfoot type creatures, Jeff, what do you think?
We don't have any second place footage when it comes to Bigfoot. In other words, there's nothing that's that compelling. We see a lot of things that could be a Bigfoot, but because of the format they were filmed on, we don't know. And they're not going to go any further than they've already gone. That's why nothing is as compelling as what we see in the Patterson film. Because of digital technology, everybody's got these cameras walking around with them at all times now. But at the same time, if you film the Bigfoot on film and you can't analyze it much further, what good is it? It doesn't do much good, and that's why people, when you see stuff on YouTube, people upload mysterious creature footages all the time up there. But they don't get a lot of interest for that reason. One, they can't be analyzed any further. And it's just what we see in there is just so distorted, or that it's obscured by trees so much usually. You know, the Patterson film was in an open field. That's another thing that's very unique about it. When you see a lot of these alleged Bigfoot sightings nowadays, they're always obscured by trees, bushes. This thing was walking in an open field in broad daylight, which takes a lot of confidence, I would think, if you're faking a footage to say, hey, I can – this looks so good that, you know, we could just do this in broad daylight in an open field. And, you know, whereas a lot of the stuff you see nowadays happens to be obscured by trees, and it just doesn't seem that credible. And if it is real, you know, we can't analyze it any further.
That's right. There's a lot of interesting aspects to the story, and some of them we're going to continue in detailing here as we proceed after we take a little break here. In a few minutes, but I want to talk a little more about the book here, and obviously again give out the website pattersonfilm.com, and also of course the title of the book is The Great Bigfoot Film Mystery, I guess going to the website is the best place to pick up a copy of your book, Jeff, correct?
Yeah, you can buy it anywhere internationally. Go to pattersonfilm.com, it'll get shipped to you, pay through PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, however you like. You can send me loose change, cash, I don't care. No, just do it through PayPal through my website, pattersonfilm.com. It's a great book. I hope you buy it and check it out, and I think you're going to learn a lot about this mystery and how deep it exactly goes.
That's right, and again, it only takes one of these creatures, basically, to prove their authenticity. It only takes one 100% accurate sighting to make this whole area, obviously, of opening up. And that's what's so exciting about it, of course, and other people have made comparisons with other creatures as well, by the way, that we, humanity, have known about and looked for many, many years. I heard one story, for instance, about the mountain gorilla, that although humanity even knew in what area to look for the mountain gorilla, it still took them about, I can't remember the exact date, but we're talking about 40 to 50 years, I think, to actually pin one down and actually photograph one or get the first one on video or whatever they had back then. I can't remember the full story, but there's a number of these cases, and that means people say, if it was out there, we would have found it by now. But there's plenty of species, Jeff, that is being discovered all the time, and specifically we're talking about some kind of hominid in this case. They would know to stay away from the populated areas where mankind has spread out, and there's plenty of places, by the way, around the world that isn't, covered by our civilization. There's a lot of wilderness out there, and I think people tend to forget that as well, Jeff.
That's a very, very good point. Yeah, the lowland gorilla wasn't discovered till the mid-1800s. That was used to be a mythical creature, too, much like Bigfoot. People thought it was just tall tales by people that were aborigines, tribal people, until they discovered one. It's a very fascinating story when you look at both the mountain gorilla and the lowland gorilla stories. In fact, there was a case in the mid-1800s where they actually had a gorilla in their midst before people even knew what a gorilla was. There was a menagerie traveling around at the time, and they had this bizarre-looking – they knew about monkeys then. They knew about chimpanzees, but they actually had a baby gorilla with them. And they didn't know, they just thought it was a weird-looking chimp. And the thing toured around with them for a while. It had its own pet dog, and it wore clothes. Its name was Jenny. You can do a little bit of research on it. It's a fascinating story. And the thing died because they really didn't know how to take care of it. But that was a really fascinating case that there was a gorilla in the midst of people that people were looking at, and they didn't even know what they were seeing.
Well, there you go. That's a good example. That's the level of perception and knowledge that we do have, yet so many people are willing to discredit it out of hand just simply because there's no, from their point of view, evidence for it because they haven't studied the evidence. So it says a lot. But again, on the website here, pattersonfilm.com, head on over there, check out the material that Jeff has up there on the website for you. A lot of good stuff to look through. A lot of the video material, of course, as well that we've been talking about here. And stay with us, Jeff. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue with more in a little bit.
Where we go from here, is anybody's guess. These thoughts I've got inside ain't easy to confess. My hands upon my heart, I draw a little breath. 'Cause I've fallen down. Ships across the ocean, and I've lost all my reason. But if you are still believing, and looking in your eyes, stars they fall away. But I'm not so strong, and I see that I feel that it's all too real. On a wave of emotion, sending ships across the ocean, and I've lost all my reasons. When it's you I care.
Come back after the break. We'll proceed to discuss the Patterson film and the Great Bigfoot Mystery with Jeff Hilling, beginning with the historical comparisons to other creatures that mankind has looked for in the past and the difficulty in obtaining evidence for their existence. For instance, from the discovery of the first mountain gorilla that was shot, actually, it took about 40 years before they properly was located and could be studied. We discuss Bob Hieronymus and other people who claim they were behind the hoax of the Patterson film. We also talk about the embarrassing attempts by some TV programs to recreate this so-called hoax. Today we're in the realm of CGI and the aspiration of viral 15-minute YouTube fame. It was a different time in the 60s, and there's so many things pointing to the fact that this film might be the real deal. We'll talk more about that when we return with Jeff Hilling. RedEyesCreations.com, go to our radio archive and click into Hour 2 if you want to hear more. Log in or subscribe, stream or download from the website. You can also access the program through our RSS feeds or iPhone app. All the details are on the website. Red Eyes Radio will be back before you know it with Alex Putney, Carl Munk, Bob Frisell, Asharia S., Mark Passio, Anthony Peak, Andrew Goff, Dr. Robert Verkirk, Joseph Atfill, Sonia Barrett, Håkan Blomqvist, Paul Levy, and Dean Clifford. That's later. This is now. Stay with us for Hour 2.